Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin.
I had the incredible honor of sitting down with the great Steve Vai and asking him some questions about the incredible music that he's given us through the years. So he goes on about Joe Satriani, Randy Coven, and how he took lessons from Satch and went to Berklee University.
Yeah, because Joe was three or so years older than me, and he grew up in my town, the same town. Well, actually, he was in the next town, but right on the border. So we all went to the same school. You know, his group was a little older, but he always played great, it seemed, you know, even as a teenager. So all of us in my group, a lot of us were taking lessons from him. And I knew of Joe, and I've seen him at school, but I didn't meet him or know him. And then when my friend John Sergio, who was taking lessons from Joe, gave me Joe's number, I called him and started lessons. And I kicked off lessons with him at probably 12 years old. And I went to his house and I had a pack of strings and a guitar with no strings. I didn't know anything. Yeah, for years, you know, probably 3 or 4 years on and off when Joe was in town, he taught me. He taught me everything, you know, about the guitar. We had both taken a very, very intensive music theory class in high school because the teacher was like a Juilliard graduate and a savant, and he pounded us with intense theory, and we just absorbed it. But I used it compositionally because I loved to compose. I started composing for orchestra at a very early age. And I wrote my first orchestra score in high school, and I was using all this vast theory information for composing, but I wasn't really applying it to the guitar. You know, I was just playing Led Zeppelin songs and stuff. And when I would go to lessons with Joe, one of the many things that he helped navigate for me was all that music theory to appear in the landscape of my guitar. You know what I mean? Yeah, so that was vital training. Yeah, when I got to Berklee, I was stunned at all the guitar players, all the musicians that were accomplished, it seemed, on their instrument. And there was a lot of great bass players, but Randy just stuck out. I mean, he was something else. You know, he played fretless, and his intonation was immaculate. And he had that Jaco kind of approach, and he had chops, you know. And we just became really good friends. We were very, very close friends. And at first, he was in another band at college. I think it was called Winter. I'm not sure. And I was working with Stu Hamm. That's where I met Stu. Yeah. And then Randy, I started playing with Randy. And we had, you know, Morning Thunder was our band for some years, and with Dave Rosenthal, who's going to be here tonight at the show in Jersey. Yeah, really cool. And it was a great period. We were accomplished, but very, very green. You know what I mean? At that age, you know, understanding groove and real improvisation on a deep level, I don't know anybody that age that has that kind of insight, but that's the time period where you're developing your chops, you're processing academic information, you're experimenting with, we were experimenting with intensely complex music, you know, because that's what we liked. You know, and but we were young, so there was rough edges, so to speak. Yeah, that's how you do it. You get with really great people and you just drill, drill, drill. There was a handful of guitar players that were just stunning. This one guy, Lorne Lieber, I followed him. I watched him. He was miraculous, really, what he could do. His mind and his chops. He picked every note and he played angularly. And he could create like a synthetic scale and know all the chords on the neck within like 5 minutes and then be able to improvise over it ridiculously. Yeah, it was incredible. And there was another guy, Mike Radetzky. He was quite good. He had a tragic end, though. He ended up working with Boy George, you know, in the 80s. And, yeah, and he died of a heroin overdose. But, yeah, there was a lot of good players. And I could never really understand why they hadn't risen in the cachet the way I was at the time. You know, I was going from one really great gig to another, and I couldn't understand it because I always thought they were just so much better than me. But then, you know, I started to get it. Everybody finds their own niche, you know what I mean? And my niche was just that crazy rock and roll, over-the-top stuff that I was doing.
That's the stuff we love, Steve, that crazy over-the-top rock and roll guitar. We had a mutual friend, the great Randy Coven, who was an astounding bass player, and he explains how he got hooked up with Frank, and Randy lent him the money to call him.
In my apartment, I couldn't afford a phone. And whenever I needed to make a phone call, I would go to one of two places. One of them was, well, one of three places. One of them was my neighbor, this girl I was going to school with. Another one was Amy Mann, because she was a schoolmate at Berkeley. And another one was the drummer, Eddie Rogers. He had an apartment and a phone. So if I wanted to call Frank, I had to use somebody else's phone. So it's very likely that Randy may have loaned me the money because I was flat busted, man. Well, it started before I got to Berkeley, when I was just a young teenager in my bedroom practicing, and a friend came by and he had a Rolodex. He says, "Hey man, look at this Rolodex. I stole it from a studio in New York City, and it has all these famous people's contact information in it." And I'm like, and he's reading me the names, and I'm just sitting on my bed practicing, and he's going in alphabetical order, of course. He's got, "I've got Mick Jagger's number here." And I'm, "Oh, interesting. Oh, I got, you know, Bob Dylan's contact." And, you know, he's going on all these people. I'm like, "Oh," and then he gets to the Z's and he goes, "And I have Frank Zappa's home phone number." And I just like, it stopped me dead in my tracks. I'm like, "You what? No, you don't. You can't. How could you? That's not Frank Zappa's number." So I took the number. And shortly after that, I was in college, and the first time I called Frank, I was, I can't remember if I was home or if I had been to Berkeley at the time, but I just cold called. And, oh, no, I was home. I was 16, and I called the house, and his wife, Gail, answered. And after I got to know Gail, I can't believe she took the call, you know, and she even engaged in a conversation, because I'm like, I'm just a fan. I love Frank's music. I would love to talk with him. And she said, "I mean, you get a phone call like that, you're just like, Frank doesn't live here. I don't know who you're talking about. Click." And she said, "Well, Frank is on tour. He'll be back in 6 months. You can call them." Right. So I'm like, okay. So I waited around the phone for 6 months. You know, and I called, and again she answered and said, "Well, he's still out. You'll have to call in another," you know. So I did that every 6 months until I was at Berkeley, and I was at I think I was at Eddie, maybe that's when Randy gave me the money to make the call, and Frank answered the phone. It was a miracle, and he was in a good mood, and he actually gave me, this is like a perfect storm, because knowing Frank, the fact that he was talking to this kid that just called his home, that he picked up the phone, you know, and he's, and I'm like, "Well, I'm just a fan, and I really love your music. I'm a guitar player at Berkeley. I want to play in your band, and I'd like to send you some stuff." And my in was, Frank was an Edgar Varese fan. Edgar Varese was a very contemporary composer, and he was looking for some scores, and the Boston Public Library had Edgar Varese scores. So I went down there and Xeroxed them, and I said, "And I also have Edgar Varese scores." You know, and he's like, "Okay, here's my home address." And I sent him the scores. I sent him a tape of Morning Thunder. Maybe it was called Axis at the time, because no, Axis was the first band, I think. Yeah, and then Morning Thunder was the band with Randy. So I also sent him a transcription I did of a very dense piece of music that he wrote called The Black Page. So after I sent him all this stuff, I didn't know if I'd ever hear from him again, but I got this package in the mail at Berkeley. And I went to my little post office box, and there was a note that there was a package for you. So I went and I picked up the package. It's a giant score, musical score of a Frank Zappa piece, two pieces in one. And the name of the, it was a different title at the time, but it was a piece that was eventually titled Mo and Herb's Vacation. And it was this huge score, and it was just gorgeous. And he sent me the actual sheet music for the Black Page. And he said, make me a cassette of you playing the Black Page on the guitar as fast as you can play it. So I went to work and I recorded it and I sent it to him, and he wanted to audition me for the band, but I told him I was 18, and he said, forget it, you're too young. Yeah, but he hired me to transcribe, and he started sending me all this very, you know, all these guitar solos and drum parts and everything. So I did that for a while. I left Berkeley, and I was transcribing for Frank. And then a day after my 20th birthday, I moved to California, virtually down the street from his house, and just started going up to the house. And within a few months after I left Berkeley, I was on tour with Frank Zappa. Yeah, it was a shock, you know, because I had no idea what that world was like. I mean, I was 20. I was so green, so innocent, so naive. And there I was, you know, and Frank's touring was brutal. You know, the way he toured, I would never tour like that again. I mean, Frank, first of all, we had 80 songs in the repertoire, and 60% of them were just death-defying on the guitar. I had to practice them constantly, constantly, constantly. And with Frank, he would write the set list literally 5 minutes before we went on stage. And it was different. It was different every night, every tour I did. It was never the same. And you had to know the songs, you know. So on tour with Frank, you wake up at like 9 a.m. You get in the car, you go to the airport, you have to fly to the next gig. You get right out of the airport, you go from the gig to the venue. And as soon as you get to the venue, you start sound checking. Frank sound checked right up to doors. Sometimes it was 2 hours, sometimes it was 4 hours. And he'd be rehearsing, he'd be changing songs, he'd be writing songs, he'd be recording. And then you get a 45-minute break. You do one show for about 2.5 hours. You get another 45-minute break, and usually it was two shows. So then by the time you get out of the gig and back to the hotel, it's 1 or 2 a.m., and I have to practice because I don't know what songs he's going to call the next day. You know, if he called something like Maggio or Alien Orifice or the Black Page or any of that stuff, I had to have it. You know, I had to own it. And so I had to constantly keep practicing. So for the first 2 weeks of that tour, I didn't know how I was. I didn't think I was going to make it. So I'm surprised I survived those Zappa tours. Towards the end, when I did the last tour with him in Europe in the summer of 82, it started to get real good. You know, I started to find my footing, and that was a very enjoyable tour. Actually, when I first got to California and I started going up to the house, Frank had me recording guitar parts for You Are What You Is. So I thought that was going to be the next record. But before you knew it, we were on tour, and that record wasn't completed. So what he did was he culled a record out of the 80 tour, and that was Tinseltown Rebellion. And then he released, if my memory serves me, I would highly recommend corroborating anything I tell you with real facts. Then it was You Are What You Is. And it's a blur, because with Frank, first he worked around the clock, you know, so Frank would stay up like 2 extra hours a night and revolve around the clock. And when he needed you, you just had to be there. And you'd be recording stuff that you didn't know where it was going to end up or what he was working on. So I would just record, record, record. And then Frank would, you know, release a record. So for the 81 tour, I think that's when Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch was the workhorse, you know, that's, he would come in with scores for that in rehearsal. He did teach us stuff and, you know, he just sort of manifested the record. And then we toured on that. And then in 82, we did the European tour. And one of the records that was called from that, I believe, is The Man from Utopia. Well, it was all very surreal to me. You know, I couldn't understand how it is that I got there and why I was there, you know, because these guys just, they were my heroes and they were all just extremely talented and accomplished. And I get to Frank's house and, you know, I've studied Bozio and Vinny, and there they are. They're at the house. They're at the rehearsal. I'm playing with them. Like, what the heck? And shortly after I got there, I was sitting in the studio with Frank. It was just me and him, and we're playing. And we're just jamming. And we're playing Sleep Dirt. And Frank starts playing the rhythm part, and he kind of nods to me to solo. And there I am soloing with Frank Zappa playing rhythm guitar. And I stopped, and because I was just kind of like stunned, like, what's going on here? You know? Well, Frank was brilliant at knowing what to give musicians, because he never gave you something that you weren't going to be good at. And those things that you were good at, he could see that you were much better at them than you thought. So he would push you and give you things that were within your wheelhouse, but just slightly beyond your reach, that you could grab, you know? So you were always given something to ascend to. But a lot of it was just simple, you know, okay, this is, you know, Broken Hearts for Assholes. All right, I know how the guitar part goes, you know? but when it came time for something complex, he gave me those melodies. And I just had a interest in doing all that stuff. So it was an opportunity for him to have those melody lines played on a guitar, which he really didn't do in the past. Well, Them or Us was another one that I think a lot of it was called from the European tour, but I'm trying to think the songs on Them or Us. I mean, there's songs that I've performed with Frank that have long, beautiful, incredible guitar melodies, and some of them intensely complex, like Sinister Footwear. You know, that's like, you know, 8 minutes of sheer terror, you know, or Maggio, you know, Maggio, to this day, when I hear it, my stomach gets weak, you know, it's so hard to play, and so many others, but some of it was so profoundly beautiful. Like, I would stand out there under the starry skies in these giant outdoor festivals with Frank, and they were his shows, and they were tens of thousands of people, because he's huge in Europe. And I'd be able to play things like Sofa, you know, the main melody, or Rudunzel, you know, or Strictly Genteel. And these are like just inspired melodies, and they go on and on and on. And it was glorious. Here's the thing about Frank: any means necessary. You would never know what's under the hood, because it's unlike any other artist you have ever known. So you might hear a song, and the drum part might have been recorded live at a concert in Cincinnati, and then the guitar parts might have been flown in from a show someplace else. And then you had to then put a part on in the studio. So it's any means necessary. Frank did all sorts of things that people didn't think of doing. They didn't even imagine doing. Yeah, he was an audio pack rat. There were records coming out for 20 years after I left the band that I was on. And I still hear stuff. You know, they pull stuff from the vault, and I'm like, oh, there I am. I think I counted once, I'm on like 20 records or something.
That's unbelievable. I know when I spoke to Adrian Belew, he said that Frank recorded everything. Now Steve tells me how he recorded Flexible, that unreal album that changed my life forever as a guitarist.
Frank was so generous. He kind of quietly mentored me. You know, you'd never say that to Frank, because he wouldn't want to consider himself mentoring anybody. But he did, and he loaned me gear. I saved up all my money with Frank, and I bought this little house, and I had a bunch of friends living there that paid rent. And there was a shed out back that I turned into a studio. And Frank loaned me a lot of really good gear. And I just started playing with it. I had no perspective of the future. You know, I didn't have any expectations. I just loved the idea of recording music. So I just constantly recorded. And even before I knew Frank as an artist, we had similar kind of propensities. You know, I loved composition from a very early age. I have a quirky sense of humor. I like theater. And Frank was doing all of this. You know, he had orchestral music. He had orchestrated band music. He had tons of improv, comedy, visceral guitar playing. It was just everything. When I heard his music, it like checked all my boxes, you know. So I was able to get involved with him the way I did. But when I had left Frank, and he had quit touring because the last show we did in Europe in Palermo, Sicily, a riot broke out. And yeah, it was the first time they ever had a rock concert in Palermo, Sicily, in Sicily. And there was 180,000 people at the concert. And it turned into a riot because of the police. And three kids got shot. And yeah, and we had to escape with bulletproof vests in between cars, you know. And that was the last show. And I flew home. And when I woke up in the morning, I read in the paper what had happened. In America, I read what happened at the show in Sicily. And Frank was, you know, obviously very distraught about this. And he just said, that's it. I'm never touring again. Of course, he went out several years later again. But he also discovered the synclavier. And Frank stayed home for a while and just pounded on the synclavier and let go of everybody, you know. And it was perfect timing for me because I had really gotten everything that I needed for my own launching pad from Frank. But when I did start experimenting and recording and playing with studio stuff, my musical tastes were still very influenced by Frank, you know, because I was in that world, and Flexible was the product. Well, some stuff was written in high school. Some stuff was written in college. The song Call It Sleep was a harmony assignment. Mike Matheny, Pat Matheny's brother, was my harmony teacher at Berkeley. And we used to have to write music and have it analyzed and everything. So I pulled a lot of songs that I wrote from that class that eventually made their way into my catalog. And then there was stuff I wrote when I was with Frank. You know, songs like Salamanders in the Sun was written in a hotel room in Florida, and There's Something Dead in Here was written on airplanes. And you know, there was some stuff, it came from all over, and it was finally an opportunity for me to record this stuff and actually hear it, you know. So that was exciting. Yeah, because I played with Stu in college, and then when I moved out to California and got things, you know, situated, I called Stu and said, okay, come on out. And he came out, and he lived in our house in Sylmar, and we played together for quite a while. Flexible, yeah, it's a few various people, but Chris Frazier played most of the drums. Chad Wackerman played on Junkie. Yeah, and then there was a Lynn drum machine that Frank loaned me. Yeah, that's like Little Green Men and Salamanders. A couple of them were recorded with the Lynn. You know, I was just thinking, what do you want to do? What's on your mind? What music are you aching to record and hear? You know, and because I have a lot of those Zappa-esque tendencies, you know, they were polished up a bit while working with Frank. But really, when I sat down to do Flexible, there was so much more music I recorded than what I released. Because I just loved the process. So anything that came to mind in the moment, or anything that I had on the back burner that I knew I wanted to record, that's what I worked on. And I wasn't even planning on releasing it. It just seemed like too weird of a record, you know? I mean, if you listen to that record, like, who would release something like that wanted to have a career in the music business, you know. but I didn't care. I didn't know. I felt more free, more open than any other time in my life when I was recording Flexible. And Passion and Warfare, I must say. Well, what happened was I recorded so much stuff, and once I got a bigger machine that could handle more tracks, I started recording things that were pointing towards a more mature, polished record. But then I was, and that ended up being Passion and Warfare. But after releasing Flexible, I continued recording, but I never completed because I was just like, well, let me move on to something. And then I didn't have time to because I had joined Dave Roth or Alcatraz.
Yeah, I could imagine he was hot and everybody wanted Vi on their record. So Alcatraz, David Lee Roth, and Whitesnake came one after the other for Steve. And he explains how he got each of those gigs.
The Alcatraz opportunity came and I took that and had a nice little run with them. Had to put a lot of stuff on the shelf. But what happened was, many years later, I took that stuff and finished it, and that became Modern Primitive. And I also added some stuff to it. And that record, Modern Primitive, is one of my favorite records that I ever released. It's so deep, and it's very Vi in its quirkiness, but it's the missing link between Flexible and Passion and Warfare. Because if you listen to Flexible and then Paw, it's like two different guys. Modern Primitive is the missing link. You can really hear the transition. Yeah, Flexible Leftovers was another record that I released that really is leftover stuff from the making of Flexible. But then that in-between period, the stuff started to mature, you know, because my studio experience, engineering and producing, was maturing. But when I sat for Passion and Warfare, I had different intentions. So I left all that stuff. And there's tons more. Yngwie Malmsteen had hit the scene and we all just fainted, you know? You know, because we'd never heard guitar playing like that. He was shocking the community. And when he left that band, they needed a guitar player. And I found out. And I found out where they were having auditions. And I went down. And they had 3 gigs left on their tour and they needed somebody to fill in it for Yngwie, if you can imagine. Yeah, and I walked in and I played, and 3/4 of the band didn't want me. And yeah, but the keyboard player, Jimmy Waldo, because right after as I was walking out, another guitar player got up there and started playing. And I'm listening to this guy, and he was just blowing me away, you know, and it was Chris Impellitteri, because he had all the Yngwie stuff down. He was Yngwie, basically, at that time. And I thought, okay, there's their guitar player. They're going to pick this guy, of course, you know? And that's who they wanted, except for Jimmy Waldo. He refused. He said, we cannot get an Yngwie clone. You know, we have to get this Steve Vai guy has got something going on. And he may not fit the Yngwie mold, but we have to get him. So I was hired for the band, and I had literally a day and a half to learn their entire set and finish the shows. Well, what I would do is I'd play all the necessary parts of the song. And then for the solos, if there was something in the solo that was kind of that I felt needed to be there, I would do some of that. But I couldn't play like Yngwie. Well, yeah, I wrote most of the music with Graham Bonnet. Yeah, and then we released a record through Capitol, Disturbing the Peace, and kind of tried to embark on a tour. But back then, you know, MTV was king along with radio. And it was, you know, you had to play these radio games and MTV games. And it just made me a little sick. But I tried. We had booked a little tour of America, and we only got like 3 or 4 shows into it because I remember arriving in Phoenix and there was like 14 people in the audience. Yeah. I mean, it was rough. So we couldn't afford to continue touring. And right at that time, Dave Roth was looking for a guitar player, and he called me. So that started the new chapter. Yeah, he was working with Billy Sheehan, and I think they played with a few guitar players. But then Billy said, you know, this guy, Steve Vai, is, you know, he's the new hotshot. So Dave called me. It's the weirdest thing. You know, the weird thing about it was, I remember being in my apartment in L.A., and the word was out that David Lee Roth was starting a band. And I, you know, the guitar spot for that band was the most coveted guitar position that anybody could possibly slip into, you know, and I knew that every guitar player in the world wanted that gig. But the odd thing was I knew it was mine. I don't know why. Yeah, it was just like, okay, this is next. This is your gig. Everybody wants it. And there's nothing you can do about it, but it's yours. It wasn't even something that I said, I want that gig. I'm going to, who do I call? What do I do? It just felt like, just wait. And sure enough, the phone rang. It was Dave Roth. Interesting, because I just thought, okay, you're stepping in it again. You know, you stepped into Frank's band, replacing guitar players. You stepped into Alcatraz, replacing a great guitar player. You're stepping into Dave Roth, which is, you're replacing the guitar behind that voice, you know. and what's really odd, when I look back, and I never mentioned this ever in the press, when I was going to Berkeley, I was a fan of the band UK, and that was Eddie Jobson and Holdsworth and Bill Bruford, John Wetton. I love that band. I transcribed their whole record. Yeah, that first record. Yeah, and I showed it to Eddie Jobson. And Alan Holdsworth left the band. And I sent Eddie Jobson a tape. And he called me. And he wanted to audition me for UK. Yeah, I was 18. Trying to replace Alan Holdsworth. Can you imagine that? Yeah. And at the same time, Frank was calling. So I kind of had to make a choice, you know, and I didn't think the UK gig was quite right anyway, you know, and then they ended up going out as a trio and didn't even have a guitar player. Yeah. So there was that. I seemed to be that guy, you know, and then, you know, even now today, I'm jumping into this beat band and playing all Robert Fripp's guitar parts, which are the most challenging thing I've ever engaged in on the guitar. Totally his own thing. He's as brilliant as they get. Yeah. He's a giant among big people. Do you know what I mean? When I approached the project, it wasn't with the mindset of replacing Edward, because that's just foolish. You know, you can't replace Edward. I knew that we had a great record with Eat 'Em and Smile, and that was all very me. And I knew I could play the Van Halen songs, and I loved them. They fit just so beautifully on the guitar. But nobody has Edward's sound, you know, and I wasn't even going to try. Because I just felt, forget that. I'm going to tear this shit a new asshole, you know, in my own way, you know. What's the alternative? So I just dove in as hard and as fast as I could. Oh, he wanted it. That's why he hired me. Yeah, and that came about because I had just released Passion and Warfare, and it was blowing up, but I didn't know how to tour on it. And I didn't know if I'd be very comfortable as a front person, you know. And I liked being on the side and having guys like Coverdale and Roth and Graham Bonnet and Frank Zappa, you know, running things in the front. So I decided to take the Whitesnake gig. I loved the music. And David Coverdale, I mean, I love great singers, you know. He was just amazing. He had all the goods, you know, because a lot of singers, you can get by if you have the lead singer DNA, the rock, you know, the rock star lead singer DNA, and your voice is okay. And you can also get by if you have a really great voice, but you don't necessarily have a lot of the enigmatic lead singer chutzpah that's necessary in owning and controlling an audience. But rarely do the two come together, and they come together in David Coverdale. It's great music to play. He knew how to throw a rock and roll show, man. It was great. We did a huge tour. It was fantastic.
Yes, that's really true, Steve. David Coverdale had the goods, and he really knew how to show it, and he knew how to work the crowd. Now Steve tells me about that green Charvel from Flexible and his Ibanez Gem.
Well, that was a transitional guitar because that was 22 fret, sort of super strat, because that's where we started putting different pickups. And then the tremolo, I made it a floating, like real floating. And so that was kind of transitional, but I didn't like the shape. It was too pedestrian and it didn't have enough frets. And I just wanted something new. One of those things that I picked up from working with Frank, because Frank was very irreverent when it came to a guitar. You know, he would do things that, you know, change necks. He would put electronics in it that nobody would do. He had a Jimi Hendrix burned guitar from Miami. And he like took the pickups out and changed them because he wanted different pickups. You know, yeah, he didn't care. So I just thought, well, I like Strats and I like Les Pauls, but they're not really right for me. What do I want? And this was before I was really known. And I just thought, and I designed the Gem, you know, and I went to a little guitar shop in Hollywood, and I got the bodies, and I said, cut it away here so I could reach the frets, because none of these other guitars you could comfortably reach the frets. And I wanted 24 frets, which was very, it didn't exist really in that kind of a strat, super strat body. And the pickup configurations were unique, and the whammy bar floating. I just built what I wanted, what my idiosyncrasies were reaching for, you know what I mean? And that turned into the Gem, and I had four of them made. And then the guitar companies were interested in having me endorse them. And of course, I didn't want to play any other guitar but that. And they said, well, we'll make that. So I sent the design to all the companies that were interested, which are the major companies, and they just botched it all up. They didn't take it seriously. They gave me their guitars with my name on it and a couple of little changes. I'm like, okay, thanks, but no thanks. Yeah, except for Ibanez. Even Ibanez sent me their first guitar. It was terrible. It was nothing like what I wanted. It was their idea of what they wanted me to play for their marketing and stuff. And I'm just like, that. And that's what everybody did. But when I said no thank you to Ibanez, they said, well, okay, wait, what about this? And then they brought me a Gem. They made it exactly the way I wanted it. And it hasn't changed since. I'll tell you the weirdest thing about my career. The fact that I'm going on stage tonight with Joe Satriani. I mean, you can't write this stuff. 52. Yeah, and it's all through the years we've been joined at the hips, you know, and it's just surreal. It's kind of it's remarkable. Yeah, how do you comprehend that? My whole career is it's like a charmed life. I never had to ask for anything; it all just came. And I'll tell you this. I know why, and the reason why is because my main interest through it all was the guitar and was music and creating a technique and a note choice that really resonated with me. And I always loved to imagine things that I couldn't play and then work on them until I could play them. So this developed chops, tone, technique that was of service to others. Do you know what I'm saying? So they would say, oh, that, I want that. And then they reach out to me, you know, and my whole career has been that way. Well, Frank had a deal with Carvin, and that was the first time I started having any kind of a dialogue with an amplifier company. And that lasted for a long time, and we ended up making some great stuff.
Yes, I remember the Legacy amp by Carvin. I was actually endorsed by them as well, and that was such a great amp. Now he tells me about the big Satch Vi tour that he's on and what new music we can expect.
We're going all over America right now. It's a North American tour, basically. And, you know, when you do a tour the way we tour, there's usually 90 to 100 shows in North America that constitute a pretty comprehensive tour. And this is sort of like a first leg. And the way we're doing, so we're only doing like 30 or 40 shows. And the way we're doing it, it's more like a G2, as you saw. It's I do a set for an hour, and then Joe does a set, and then we come out and we jam at the end. And what we're kind of working on right now is some new music for a record. You know, we're hoping to have that out by next year or next year sometime. And then, you know, the configuration of how we, you know, the optics of how we tour might change on that. When Joe and I first talked about touring together like this, we didn't really plan on anything extra, just like, you know, two bands and then a jam. But then we started thinking, hey, it'd be nice to have some new music. And before I knew it, Joe, you know, sent me an email and he had these two beautiful tracks in it that he had written. And he called it the Sea of Emotion Part 1 and 2 because the Sea of Emotion is a location where we grew up. It's this huge field that sits in the middle of the various schools, you know, the kindergarten, grade school, and high school. And as teenagers in the town we grew up in, this was like a giant den of iniquity. You know, we used to go there and just do all sorts of crazy teenage things. And Joe was older than me. So his group of friends were different. I would take lessons and he lived right down the street, this Sea of Emotion. And we'd go there and just sit. And I was, you know, 12, 13, 14, and he was a little older. And we would just sit and, you know, talk about all those teenage things, you know, discovering the universe or whatever. And so he wrote these two songs sort of based on that location and that period. And once I heard them, I was inspired to write a piece of music that starts with a recording of Joe and I as teenagers. Because when I used to go to lessons, he had this tape recorder, reel to reel. And one day I was playing for about a year and a half. So I must've been like 13 or 14 and showed me this riff and we recorded it. And then he sent me the reel to reel, like, you know, I don't know, 20 years later. And then I transferred it to digital, just had it and was inspired to create a song that's actually starts out with the original, a little clipping of our jam. So you get to hear Steve and Joe as teenagers for a second, and then it blasts into part three. So we're having so much fun doing this that we just thought, you know, let's write a whole record, you know? And as soon as we decided to do that, it was like the creative floodgates opened up and we're trading files and all. And this is in hopes that next year we can release a record, but the real challenge is, our time, you know, because Joe's going out with Sammy and I'm going out with Beat. And, you know, we have to kind of figure out recording in between there. But we're very confident that that'll all happen.
It was such an honor and pleasure to sit down with Steve and talk to him. He's a great guy and he's such an accomplished musician through all these years. Now I'm going to play some Frank Zappa with Steve on it. Theme of the third movement of Sinister Footwear. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, this is Steve Vai, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT.
Heads up!
That is Liberty by Steve Vai, and before that was the ultimate guitar song, the Attitude Song by Steve